You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Let me paint you a picture, all right?
Mm-hmm. This is a audio only.
Yeah. I'm going to describe it.
Oh,
beautifully.
Got it. Oh, okay.
Beautifully. It's 1983, and there's a young man by the name of Blake Collins who is potentially one of the greatest cricketers that this world has ever seen.
Yep.
He's gone back 15 paces on his long run. He's an express bowler. He's got his shirt button unbuttoned down to his belly button. The collar on his white shirt is similar to that the Bee Gees once wore. And in he comes. Look at the smooth. He's got to run up as smooth as Michael Holding as he runs into bowl. Oh, my goodness. Have a look at the pace at which he bowls here to Devadas. Devadas plays forward straight through him, bowls him.
I like how your commentary voice got older and older.
I don't know why I started to talk like it. Yes, I don't know why that happened, but it did.
Was that a childhood dream of yours, bowling me out?
I had this. We've all had these childhood dreams that we wanted to be something or other, and mine was absolutely to be a cricketer, a bowler for Australia. What was yours?
I probably would have taken any sport, but definitely cricket.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely athletics, maybe football.
Yeah.
Because I came to football a lot later in life. But, absolutely. You'd want to be on the Olympic team, or you'd want to be on, you know, a team that, you know, had lots of club supporters and that sort of thing around, or something like that.
Yeah. I reckon every kid, when their lives and judgment isn't clouded by what's real, you go, okay, I can do this, that, and the other with my life. This week's guest decided really early on that she wanted to run for Australia, and she made that dream come true.
Yeah, she did. And so I did do a lot of athletics, and what I love team sports.
Mm.
And what I found with athletics, I was a long jumper, so you spent a long time in a sandpit.
Mm.
It was all by yourself, and I didn't really like that. About athletics, that, you know, if you won, which I never did, all the glory was yours. And if you lost, all the pain and suffering was your own.
Mm.
And yes, this week's guest, Emma Carney, the great Emma Carney, actually reveled in that, in the solo pursuit, the pain and suffering. And I've got to say, Blake, this is the first ever interview I've done a hammy in. Just trying to keep up.
I know. In the lead up, I generally have a conversation with our guest, and Emma suggested that we read her book and in the lead up, and I did that, and I mentioned it pretty early on in this interview. It's exhausting. No wonder you did a hammy, mate. Like it's it is exhausting. But let's get into it. It's a cracking story of making dreams come true. There's a lot of light and shade in Emma's story, and she is an amazing human.
But before.
Oh, yeah.
G'day, Jack. This is your mum's interview. Hope you enjoy it. You're listening currently to part A of our interview with Emma Carney. Make sure you check out part B of the interview after this. Hey, Blake, before we get stuck into this episode, where should our listeners go if they want to hear more stories of people doing?
They should jump on to www.thedoolanders.com.au. And what will they find there, Nick?
No, not .com.au, Blake. Just .com.
Oh.
Don't make that mistake. You can hit us up on Facebook. You can hit us up on Instagram and our website. And you can find a whole heap of pictures, articles, links.
Recipes?
Not a ton of recipes,
okay.
But you just never know what you'll find. Thedoolanders.com. No .au.
Do it. Hey, Emma. Emma Carney. Can't believe Emma Carney is sitting in our studio. How are you, Emma?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Nick, how are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Blake. It's great to have Emma here.
It is. Hey, Emma, we always ask our guests, who are you and what do you do?
Who am I? I am, well, you've already said Emma Carney.
Mm-hmm.
I was an athlete. I was a triathlete and now I'm a mum to Jack. So I'm Jack's mum.
Jack's mum. Love it.
G'day, Jack. How are you going?
How old
is he out there? Is he listening?
He better be. How old is Jack?
Jack's in grade 5, so Jack's 10.
Is he?
But he's the boss.
He's the boss.
He's the boss, yeah.
Okay. How was the homeschooling of Jack through 2020? Were you the world's best? You're a world champion. Were you a world champion homeschooler?
No. Jack and I, well, I don't think it was Jack's fault quite so much, but I was so poor, the school offered me counselling.
Really?
We fell that far behind.
Oh, no.
And I said to the school, do we really want to open that can of worms? So that was not a big parenting hit for me.
Not one of your highlights of...
No. And Jack's, when I sent Jack off to school after the second lockdown, I said, come on, Jack, just do your test and you've got a lift now.
It's all up to you, mate. I'm wiping myself of all responsibility. you lift, son. I like it. Hey, I've just spent the last couple of days reading your book and quite frankly, I'm exhausted. Like, you have absolutely lived this thing called life, haven't you? You've packed such an enormous amount in. What I loved about it was its authenticity. So it's full of big, beautiful dreams. It's got drama, politics, gut-wrenching loss. There's a fair amount of blatant unfairness, injury, illness to world domination and performances that may never be repeated. And what I loved, as I said, was its authenticity, it's raw, and you tell it like it is. What was the experience like writing the book?
So my book is called Hardwired, Life, Death and Triathlon, and the two options I had as a title was either Hardwired because, that's the way my brain works, and as it turns out, I ended up hardwired with a defibrillator in my chest, but that's another story, or it was going to be No Plan B. So it was – the story is about – my life. I've kept diaries for most of my life and about a dream from a very, very young age of being an athlete that represents Australia. And as my career and my life sort of, I suppose, unfolded for me and I was living it, I was actually quite disappointed. And it wasn't until I wrote the book and put everything together that I've actually gone, hey, people have read it and said, that's exhausting. That's not the first time I've heard that. And it's actually been really rewarding to write and put everything down and give my account of my life.
Yeah. Because there is some – and we'll absolutely – we'll cover this off as we talk through it. But there's some moments in your life that have been really, really difficult. Not only from a personal perspective, but from a professional perspective, and we'll talk about the 2000 Olympics shortly. But it is I didn't realize, like outsider looking in, you watch you on the telly, screaming down the towards the finish line, minutes in front, and the sponsorship, the accolades, and you think, oh God, what a cracking life. But you read the book and. It was bloody hard work.
Yeah, it's funny. So the dream for me, and it was always, I always take things very seriously and I'm probably 110% into everything I do if I decide to do it. So when I went to university, didn't really want to do it, so I didn't pass. So that's the sort of the two options, either really good or really bad.
Yeah.
To be the best in the world, it was about being great in Australian sport, and to be remembered in Australian sport, you had no choice. You had to be the best in the world, and you had to be a world champion, and you had to dominate. And triathlon's not wasn't one of the top sports for recognition. So I had to dominate, and that was my ideal, and that was my dream. And yeah, some people don't share that with you. And you have to have these people in your career because they might be running a national federation, or they might be administrator, or they might be a selector, or, you know, they might be a journalist that just doesn't like you.
Mm.
So you do have situations where people aren't sharing your dream, but they're still part of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, keeping diaries and very detailed sort of documentations at the time, it's actually led for quite an interesting story of what actually goes on for an athlete.
Yeah, yeah. It's so much more than I won this world championship in 95 and this one in 95. It's so much more than that. And we'll, at the end of the recording, we'll tell everyone the best place to get your book, Hardwired. So you're the number one triathlete across the globe in 95, 96 and 97. You had 19 International Triathlon Union World Cup starts. Listen to this, Nick. Mm-hmm. 17 wins, 1 second, one did not finish. And then 4 ITU World Championships, of which you won 2. You came second in one, which you were crook. And then you came 7th, and you're also crook. But like a staggering career there. So, and we'll talk about that in a minute. One thing that we need to clear up, you were actually born in England.
Yes, big secret. I was born in England, and fortunately my father, when he was 11, he went to the movies with his granddad, or the pictures, I think they called it. Anyway, before every major movie there was a little bit of an advertisement movie, and it was on Australia. And my dad said he just sat there and just looked at these images and said to his granddad, "What is that?" And his granddad said, "Oh, that's a country called Australia. If you ever get the chance, you've got to live there." So from then on, Dad wanted to live in Australia. And he met Mum, had us, and Mum was destined to live here because her name's Sheila. So
of course. It was always going to happen. So you moved over here, and you actually you started living in a beautiful southeastern suburb of Melbourne called Glen Waverley. We both share that the place where we grew up. And you went to Mimosa Primary School, and listeners, it's a little known fact that Emma is actually the second greatest athlete to come out of Mimosa Primary School. I was, in fact, the greatest athlete. That is not true. You would not even remember me because I was just so far back. Tell us, what was it like in the Carney household as a kid growing up with your two sisters?
I suppose in comparison to other families, we may have been a little bit odd.
What do you mean? What do you mean by that?
So I'm one of 3 girls, and obviously Mum and Dad, David and Sheila, and came out to live in Australia. And, you know, Dad wanted to have the real Aussie experience, so we did settle England Waverley. And Dad's sort of always been a bit of a outdoorsy person, and Mum's very alternative. She used to sell pottery on St Kilda Market to pay our school fees. So they ended up buying a block of land out in Eltham, and we built a mud brick house.
That's right.
So that kind of behaviour I don't think is completely normal, especially when you're going to a, you know, top-tier private school and you're covered in mud all weekend, building a house, Mum selling pottery, and, you know, Dad's career was also heading into the sports industry. So yeah, he was at Adidas, and then he was one of the guys at Nike, and I sort of started getting exposed to sport and athletes and, you know, what they could achieve. And so it was it was a very positive environment as well, because everything was always possible to achieve, and I think that was a really rewarding part as well.
Yeah. As you were rolling around the suburbs of Glen Waverley, hanging out with your sisters, was it clear to you that you wanted to be an athlete as a teenager, or you wanted to go and do something else?
So we left Glen Waverley when I was about 6.
Oh, yeah.
So, that, you know, then we went out to Eltham, and I wanted to – I remember sitting in Dad's office and he was at Adidas, and so that must have been about 78, 79. And I remember I saw Rob DiCostella come in and I said, oh, what's that guy doing? Because he came in and he got all this stuff and he walked out. And when he came in, everyone was like, whoa, you know, there's Rob DiCostella, and it was like a big legend. And I thought, oh, that would be nice if you go somewhere and everyone's really excited to see you. And then I think a little bit later on I saw him on a TV running and – winning something, and I said, oh, there's a guy at your office. And Dad said, yeah, he's an athlete. And I said, really? I said, can you do that for a job? And Dad said, oh yeah, you've got to be the best in the world though. And so from then on, that was sort of the way I was going to go. And unfortunately I was really exposed to sport at school. There was a very strong sport program. I went to — I'm allowed to speak about the school.
Of course you are.
I went to Wesley College and they'd just gone co-ed.
Yeah.
So it was an environment where the school was highly encouraging women and girls, and it was an environment where it was a really, really good time. You know, if you had a passion for something as a girl, you were really backed. And so I was the first girl to run APS cross country. And Saturday mornings for me was all about seeing how many boys I could make cry, because I had never realised that it was bad to be beaten by a girl, because I came from a family of girls. Dad was always really positive about everything, and I started doing races, and I remember one day I came third at it, and there were so many people from Xavier crying, and I thought, oh, I could really get into this.
So it's just about making people cry, isn't it? Making people cry in free shoes.
Yeah, well, no, it's just I could see that I could make a difference, and I could see that I was good at something. And, I mean, the sport program at school was also, you know, the typical sports like softball and netball for girls. And I was good at them as well, because Dad had taught me how to throw and catch and, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm left-handed, so I'm unpredictable. And but I managed to get myself banned from team sports at school. And I remember one particular aggressive softball game where I was alleged to have thrown the ball at people and not to them, my fellow students, the ones that weren't watching. And I remember the sports master sat me down and said, look, Emma, it's not always all about winning. And I just looked at him and thought, what is he, what? So he said, look, I think you need to just run. So the school allowed me to just run.
So you talked about your dad. He was such a massive influence on your life and your career. And you were, as you said, this an elite runner. But he was also liked numbers and analysis, didn't he? And he suggested to you that you should try triathlon. Talk to us about how triathlon was born for you.
Well, I don't really consider that I was an elite runner. I'd run all through school, cross country and athletics. I was never beaten at school in school competition, but state championships, you know, I probably won a few titles, or second or third, but I was always on the podium. Consistent runner. I don't think I was particularly outstanding, and I never actually considered myself as talented. I just thought that I just hated to lose. So I don't want everyone to sit there and think that I was just outstanding as a junior. It was, and Dad held me back a lot, because he could see that I was such an obsessive type that if someone said to me, to be the best in the world, you need to run a marathon a day, I would have gone, oh, okay, let's go. And I would have done that from the age of six. So Dad really held me back. I finished school, started uni, hated uni.
Where'd you go to uni?
I went to uni at Monash.
Yeah. What'd you study?
Economics.
Why?
I thought that, you know, all the prize money that I was going to earn, I could.
They didn't know what to do with it. Well, that's a fair call.
Yeah, I know. At school, we were told, you know, in year 11, your subject choices are coming up. You've got to go and see the careers advisor and make sure you're choosing the right subjects. And I thought, oh, I just won't do that one. So I was actually, you know, finally bailed up by the teacher and shoved in the room. Okay, Carney, what are you going to do? And I said, look, I don't think you can help me. And she said, look, the resources at this school are so vast. We can do anything. I said, okay, I'd like to be a world champion athlete. And she said, Emma, one day you're going to have to grow up.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. And I said, well, I said, what about I just invest my money, my prize money? I can be an accountant. Like, that was so off the boil. Anyway, I started economics and I've never actually finished it. I got about halfway through, I think, and I'd started running for Australia at this point, so I'd done a couple of world cross countries. And
how'd you go at those?
Well, world cross country is we've got the race in 2022 up at Bathurst, so it's going to be quite interesting. But world cross country is basically a start line of about 500 metres long, and they put each country into they mark out a box on the floor. I think it's about 3 metres wide, and they put six athletes, three at the front, three at the back. Then they fire a gun and we just run as fast as we can to funnel off down a cross-country course. And the first K of a cross-country, world cross-country, is just really hectic.
Yeah.
So I think I was about 50th and 60th in my two races, but which was quite respectable at the time. I think I was first or second Aussie across the line. And you can lose about 20 spaces in, 5, 6 seconds in that race.
Yeah.
So it was I've never run so fast in my life. I can't remember what I was talking about.
We're going to talk about your first triathlon, but I have a quick question. So Nick and I do a bit of recreational running, and it's I'm slow. You're not bad, but I'm
– sub-elite.
Well, sub-elite. And for me, most of the time, it's about trying to think about something else to forget the pain. When you're running, what's it feel like?
Well, now I'm just trying not to set my defibrillator off.
Yeah, that's true. And we'll come to your heart a little bit later.
But when I was racing, in a race, I was making sure I was running as fast as I could at that point in time, to the extent where if I went any faster, I'd blow up.
Yeah.
So you're actually running as fast as you can.
Yeah.
That was basically what I was thinking about. And training, I mean, I can go for runs, and I don't know what I actually think about. Maybe sometimes I'll clear my head when I was writing my book or something like that. So I can, go for an hour and a half run and enjoy it. I can go for a 6-hour bike ride and enjoy it. But take me to a shopping centre and I'll collapse in 10 minutes. So it's all about the endurance of the skill.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay, cool. So your first triathlon, your dad's done the numbers and he said, I reckon this sport's for you. How was that first triathlon?
So first triathlon, I got to the stage where I was running for Australia, and the jump from junior to senior running is quite a big jump. So, you're running a sub 9:10 for 3K. To be world class, you've got to run an 8:30.
Yeah, right.
And that's not going to happen, in 2 years. You've got 5 or 6 years of really hard work. Triathlon has started to pop up on the sort of sporting landscape. Bit of a joke sport, triathlons for those that can't really do anything well. Just go and have a swim, bike and a run and be pretty average at all three, but if you put them together you might do okay. Dad said to me, why don't you do a triathlon? There was one down at Elwood. And I said, well, what are the distances? And he said, it's a 750 swim, 20K bike, 5K run. I thought, oh, how hard could that be? 20K is like riding my bike from Eltham to the city, along the Yarra Trail. Swimming, I did a bit of swimming at school. Anyway, so I went down to Elwood, and as it turned out, the swim was horrendous. It was 750 metres, and I think I lost about 7 minutes on that swim, so that was pretty much the time it should take. Got on the bike, and, normally I'm running around a track or running around a cross-country course, and you can see where your competitors are. I was like, this is a schmozzle. Yeah. So I just got on my bike and just rode flat out. It was out and back. Got back in to transition, and I thought, oh, there's a few bikes on the rack. I suppose they're in my group, but like the transition area, I had no idea. So I just started running, and every time I ran past a girl, I asked her if she was winning. And, they'd go, no. And I go, oh, I overtake her. Go to the next girl, are you winning? No. Oh. run up to the next one. So I've gradually made my way around the 5K and I was really running fast. Like I was
flying.
Yeah, no one overtook me. Finally got to a girl and I think we only had about 1,500 metres to go and I said, are you winning? She goes, yeah. I said, really? So I went past her.
Thanks.
And, yeah, I mean, I didn't really think anything of it. I thought, wow, that's really confusing, that sport, and I'm quite bad at swimming. But, yeah, Dad worked out. He bought some triathlon magazines and he worked out that I was the best triathlete in the world.
Of that one race.
Yeah.
Mathematically. Like he sat down and did all of the analysis.
Well, see, he's an accountant.
Yeah.
See, there was that skill that I was looking for.
That's it.
And I never really got there.
Yeah.
But Dad's very black and white. So if something will work on paper, and it was very, very good to have Dad in my corner because before a race I could say to Dad, okay, Dad, I have this concern. And he'd write it off. Like in a logical fashion.
Pragmatic way.
Yeah. Mm. And it actually, every problem became impossible. And he always had this rule that you've only got two problems, one you can fix and one you can't. So you can get through both of them. So don't worry about them. And that was always his advice to me in a race. And, but yeah, so Dad worked out that I was the best triathlete in the world. I need to learn to swim. He reckoned I was going to be a pretty good cyclist. Running was obviously already there. He looked at the calendar and said, there's a world championship in 18 months' time. You should qualify for the Australian team, go over there and win it on debut. My sister was like, well, what about me, Claire? And Dad said, well, why don't you race the juniors? And that was how we launched our career because we both pulled it off.
So your dad said, yeah, you look at this data. We think you're the best. In 18 months' time, go and win a world title, and you've just said, okay then.
But it wasn't just a win, was it?
No, I've won by the largest margin.
Yeah. So just
so you learnt to swim.
Yeah.
Gain 7 minutes.
So take us through, you know, in an abbreviated way, that 18 months from that first triathlon to that 1995 World Championship win.
So basically the next day, once we said, yeah, we'll do that, Dad went to work at Nike and Raylene Boyle was she's been at Nike ever since she retired and she was whatever she did there, probably not much, just being a sporting legend in a company like that. And Dad said, Raylene, I think Emma's a world-class triathlete and Claire and we need a swim and a bike coach. Now, Raylene's brother, he rode in the Olympics, so she knew Australian sport as well. And so Raylene went away and had a bit of a think and came back with two coaches. She had found Alwyn Barrett, a coach at Bulleen, and also Harry Shaw, a sneaky old school bike coach. And they both took us on. I think the first person for us to see was Alwyn. And Alwyn was very sceptical. She thought, you know, probably a father that had this ridiculous dream about his daughters. And because, you know, can you teach my daughters to swim? They need to win a world title in 18 months' time. It's like...
Crazy dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's that famous line in The Castle? Get your hand off it, Daryl.
Yeah, that wasn't the famous line I was thinking, but I reckon that's more apt. Yes. That is, yeah.
Sorry, we'll have to cut that bit.
No, not at all. Not that. Right.
So I remember turning up to Alwyn's pool and we looked really fit. You know, we would have walked in and looked two really fit-looking young female athletes because we were runners. We were lean, got in the water and we were so bad. I remember we did some kick and I didn't realise that you're supposed to have loose ankles and we actually didn't move. I said to Alwyn, I don't think I'm moving. She said, no, you're not. No, this is, wow. Anyway, we swam five times a week.
Yep.
And, you know, I didn't have time to worry about what I couldn't do because I had to get there. So, and it was about minimising the damage and it was about racing smart and you know, being sneaky in races. So if there was any area of the swim that I could run, okay, we're going to do that.
Yeah.
So wading was really good. The wetsuit swim in Wellington, which was the World Championship, was always going to be an advantage for me because it was going to float you better. And we didn't want to waste too much time in the water because we knew that, you know, you might find 30 seconds in the water by, you know, swimming an extra 5 hours a week. But on the bike, the hills around Eltham and the fitness that I could get off the bike, if I could really stomp the bike, I could put 5 minutes into the field. And my bike run combination, it was by far the best in the world, which is what won things for me.
Mm.
So you were runner elite level, cyclist. What sort of level do you think you would have been as a standalone cyclist?
If I'd been a cyclist, I'd been Olympian. Yeah.
And then so, what level did you get to with swimming?
Well, Dad's always said you've got to be international level at two sports, which is what I was in, the bike and the run, and then you should be at state level with the swim. So I was heading towards that level, but then my heart condition sort of started to slow things down. But the swim is about minimising damage.
Yeah.
So take us to Windy Wellington.
Yep.
It's 1995.
Four, sorry.
I should do my research, please.
You should read a book. Pretty good.
I have. Take us there. What were your thoughts leading into the actual event that you could win it?
Oh, yeah. It was a no-brainer. I remember flying over. We got over there probably on the Thursday before, swam the course every day. About 12 months before, we went over and did the national championships for New Zealand. So we'd raced the course, worked it all out. I remember the press conference. So World Triathlon, well, it was ITU then, now it's World Triathlon. So then the International Federation for Triathlon had their press conference, and I wasn't invited. And I was so offended. I stormed out of my hotel to Dad, and I said, "Can you believe they haven't invited me? It's so obvious I'm going to win." And Dad said, "But Emma, no one's even heard of you. You've never raced." And it was, I said, "Yeah, but you've just got to look at what's going to happen." So it was so clear in my mind. Yeah. It was so clear. And it's really funny. There was no way I wasn't going to win that. And particularly because in the morning, 2 hours before, Claire won. So I couldn't go home as a family loser. Like that was, imagine if your sister won and you didn't. Oh, my God. Especially your younger sister.
Yeah. So you cross the line. How far in front?
I think it was 2.5 minutes.
2.5 minutes. That's a long way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It was a course that suited me, though. It was a strength course. It was hilly. It was windy. And I think a lot of athletes, you know, when I had a good swim, got out on the bike, some of the athletes were sort of taken by surprise. And I've always said that if you can get on a champion's shoulder and put pressure on a champion, they are often the quickest to crack. And so I just behaved the whole week leading in as if I was going to win, and no one knew me. Wow, she's like, she's really focused. And, you know, if other athletes that had raced me leading in Australia, they knew that if they wanted to beat me, I never really made it a secret that if you wanted to beat me, you had to go to hell and back, because I was going to go there.
Yeah.
So it was sort of mentally, there's a big mental game going on.
So tell us about those 3 years when you're the best in the world, you're at the top of your powers, and reading your book, you deliberately set out to lap people on the bike. like you just, you hunt them down so that, because when you lap them, they have to stop, correct?
Correct. That was a particular case. I wasn't always cold-hearted. Well, maybe I was. So the story behind that one is there was an American.
Yes.
Okay, so in sport, you know, we have to beat the Americans. That's part of our national duty.
Yes.
And this American was proclaimed to be the next Emma Carney. And I was like, pretty sure that's just me. There's only one Emma Carney. And so she was a very, very good runner. I think she'd run in the Olympic trials for the marathon maybe, or maybe it was a 10K. Anyway, I decided that I would make it close to impossible to her to finish a race because the real Emma Carney. So, yeah, there may have been a few incidents where I was sprinting to get into transition to make sure that I got there before she could finish the second last lap. So, yeah.
Top of your powers, winning. What was life like? Did you stop and soak it up and enjoy the winning? Or was it tick, move on, unfinished business? What sort of emotion was running through your body?
It was very much tick, move on, next race. How can we get there? Stepping stone forward, problem here. There was a lot of winning, but there wasn't a lot of celebrating. Mm-hmm. And my older sister Jane, who tragically passed away, once I had retired, she did used to say to me, "You should take time to celebrate." And she's funny. She used to say to me, "I don't know how you're so mean to people and beat them." And she ended up becoming a lawyer. A very good one.
Paid to beat people.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, there wasn't a lot of celebrating, but I was taking it very much – the focus was on being an Australian sporting not hero, but sporting – like to perform as an Australian is expected to perform, and that is winning. And, when you are on a piece of paper with Emma Carney, Australia, you're representing the greatest country in the world. And I took that extremely seriously. And it was about winning things for Australia and making sure that, the Aussies are tough. It wasn't so much Emma Carney, it's that Aussie team. And I think that's where the pride comes from.
Like, you were brutal in terms of your competitiveness and your approach. Was life as an athlete brutal? Was it hard to live?
Yeah, I think it's very hard. And I see a lot of mistakes at the moment in sport. Life, there is very little athlete well-being. There's a lot of misery and suffering, and if you can out-suffer your competitors, you're going to be the best. And it's a very brutal, lonely, isolating existence because you have to do things differently. You have to put yourself beyond. There's a lot of training apps at the moment I find it quite funny that it says and elite athletes use them. There's a training stress score, and if that gets too high, it's like, it's got too high, I better back off. No, you get that figure and you blast that higher than anyone else, because that's actually been invented by someone that has never been there. So you've actually got to push the limits, and you've got to balance that. You've got to make sure you're not always suffering, because that becomes misery, and misery is no good to anyone. So you have to know when to back off. You have to know when to push. You have to do a lot on your own. There's support networks, but even that takes time away from your ability to sleep and rest and recover. So you have to have a very, very clear understanding yourself of where you're going, because you can't rely on others to get you there, particularly in an individual sport.
Mm. I'm interested in, retrospect is such a great educator, right, when we look back. And so when you've written the book and you think about that period of time when you were – by a mile, by such a long way, the very best in the world. What was the view? What was your view like being at the top of the tree when you think about you back then, in comparison to writing the book? Going, well, do you feel different now than you did back then?
Yeah, I think what the difference is now, and that's sort of shown in my coaching. So I don't think that I knew how to sort of be nice to myself, because, you don't want to be too soft. And the coaching that I do now, I try and remove a lot of the errors. And the errors are things like, say you didn't win a race. Okay, why didn't you win the race? Work that out, move on. Don't then go and punish yourself for 2 weeks of hell training because you showed some sort of, you know, despicable weakness because you were beaten. Mm. I think, yeah, it's having written the book has actually made me proud of my career.
Yeah.
I was actually a little bit disappointed in the shames. I remember when the biggest accolade I've ever had was Sport Australia Hall of Fame induction. And so that's basically a Hall of Fame where Australian sport says, hey, thanks for turning up. Now, when I was given that call, the guy rang me from Sport Australia and I thought they were going to say, you know, Emma, if you'd only been a bit better, we could have put you in. And when he said, we're going to induct you, I said, really? So, yeah, it's. I think it all is in retrospect and looking back, and at the time you're just living it and you're just trying to get as much as you can because it is a short existence at the top, so you've just got to really go for it.
And you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but what was the bit that caused you shame? Because outside looking in, like you were brutal on who you were in terms of your training, just so crazily dedicated. So what brought you shame?
I didn't have the opportunity to race the Sydney Olympics, and the Sydney Olympics I was earmarked as a gold medalist. The women's triathlon was the first event of the games, and given the success of the team leading in, you know, Australia was going to win that gold medal. And I've never actually spoken publicly about it, but it's in my book and I've had a historian recreate it. So it's not just my opinion and Dad's opinion. It's actually recreated. And whether you think it was unfair or not, I didn't win Australia that Olympic gold medal. Mm. And that is basically what drives me now to coach because I owe Australia an Olympic gold medal. And there's a lot of unfinished business there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been told by officials at Triathlon Australia, Emma, you have an unhealthy attitude toward the Olympics. Yeah, I'm completely unbalanced. I'm an elite athlete. What do you expect? Yep. And, you know, that pinnacle of sport and that I think it's the pride in my country as well. I just felt that I'd let Australia down.
Yeah. You said as a teenager you wanted to be an Olympian and not far out, like, and you look at the track record of your performance leading up to the selection period, and then there were a couple of incidences where some officials actually made some comments, and I think one of them in particular was to your dad that your selection was not guaranteed because they wanted more of a team approach. Now, statistically, if you look at the data, you should have been selected. That shame piece, that unfinished business stuff, like how does that sit with you today? Like knowing that this is the thing that you've wanted to do all your life, you look at your performances leading up and then because of politics or, I don't know, a perception that you didn't want to play the game or be a team player, that you left out.
Yeah, I think, yes, that's when sport becomes really messy. Mm. And there was a coach, so the sort of story behind that, it was Triathlon Australia employed a coach who believed that teams could get together on, get out of the water, get together on the bike and then try and blow away the rest of the field and hang on the run. So they basically come from a swim specialist background, which is the opposite of me. Sydney course was very hilly and so you had to have a bike run specialist to win that race. And I still have the fastest time over that course by 2 minutes. So the team theory was not applied to the correct course. And then there were other problems with that coach. That coach was arrested by the federal police at a national camp and probably read the book for those details. And, you know, in those days, athlete wellbeing wasn't really, you know, I said, hang on a minute, why is the coach being arrested? And so I was the difficult one. And I wonder whether if I'd been a male athlete, I would have been treated in the same way. So those sort of things weren't around. And I maybe it's a fault of mine, but I don't lower my sounders to fit in. And that's probably one of Dad's favourite quotes as well. Be yourself, and, you know, you get to the end of your life and whatever you've achieved, you've done it on your terms. And, you know, even the Poms got a sniff that I wasn't going to be selected, and they said, come and race for us. And I said, oh, sorry, guys, I'm not that desperate. And I actually got a bit of a severe reprimand for that.
Did you?
Well, Triathlon asked me to apologise, and I said, oh, come on, we've been yelling at each other for, what, 200 years now?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right, that was the end of part A of our interview with Emma Carney. Make sure you check out part B now.